Saman showed up, dressed in the traditional Ida costume, and showing remarkable self-control, went around and shook our hands and gave each of us a squeeze or pat on the shoulder before tearing open his hamper, full of infinitely better and spicier-smelling foods than anything we had. We let him eat. He went about this in the same quiet, contemplative style I had once grown used to, watching him take his lunches on the top of the pinnacle at Edhar. His face showed no curiosity as to why there were five people and five hampers, instead of some other number. In fact, he was altogether reserved and impassive, which, combined with his formal Ida garb, stirred up all sorts of old habits and social conventions that had long since settled to the bottom of my consciousness. "Earlier we were raising a toast to the memory of the late Fra Jad and the others who died," I told him, when he paused in his eating and reached for his glass. He gave a curt nod, raised the glass, and said,
"Very well, to our departed comrades."
"Yes, I know too."
"Am I the only one who suffers from funny neurological sequelae?" Archibald asked, still a bit rattled.
"You mean brain damage?" Jessery asked in a helpful tone.
"That would depend on whether it is as permanent as what ails you," Archibald fired back.
"Some of my memories are a little sketchy,"
Leo offered. Saman cleared his throat and glared at him.
"But the longer I'm awake, the more coherent I seem to get," Leo added.
Saman returned his focus to the food. Jules Verne Durand stopped by, took in the scene, and beamed.
"Ah," he exclaimed. "When I saw the five of you out of your spacesuits gasping for air like beached fish in the observatory, I feared I would never be able to look on a scene such as this one."
We all raised glasses his way and beckoned for him to join us.
"What of the others? What was done with the four corpses?" Jessery asked.
Five sets of auburn eyes went to the Lateran's face. But if Jules noted any discrepancy in the figures, he didn't show it.
"This became a topic of negotiation," Jules said. "The bodies of the four Veilers have been frozen. As you can guess, there are those of the pedestal who wish to dissect them as biological specimens."
A cloud passed over his face, and he paused for a few moments. We all knew he was remembering his wife, Lise, whose body had been subjected to the biological specimen treatment at the Convox. After getting his poise back, he went on.
"The diplomats of Arb have said in the strongest terms that this would be unacceptable, that the remains are to be treated as sacred and handed over, undisturbed, to this delegation of which you are now a part. This will occur at the opening ceremonies, which are to take place in Orb 4 in about 2 hours."
"The pedestal doesn't know yet about the everything killers lodged in your bodies, and I haven't spilled the beans, but it's really making me nervous." Had even more everything killers been brought up by the delegation? Were hundreds, thousands of them now salted around the Dabanernud? Were there some in the delegation who had the power to trigger them? I remembered, if that was the right word, for something that had not happened in this cosmos, the silver box in Fra Jad's hand, the detonator. Who of the four dozen were carrying them? More to the point, who would press the trigger? To a certain kind of mind, this would make for an acceptable trade. At the cost of 4 dozen Arbran lives, the Dabanernud would be sterilized, or at least crippled to the point where its survivors would have no choice but to surrender unconditionally. Much cheaper than fighting a war with them. For more than one reason, I was no longer hungry. Everyone else was thinking similar thoughts, and so conversation was not exactly sparkling. In fact, it was non-existent. The silence became conspicuous. I wondered what a blind visitor would think of the place, for the sonic environment was distinctly odd. The air didn't move much in these orbs. Each was warmed and cooled on a different diurnal schedule so that the expanding and contracting air would slosh back and forth through the portals and stir faint breezes down below. But it never blew hard enough to raise waves, or even to blow a leaf from a table. Sound carried in that still air, and it ricocheted strangely from the ceiling of the orb. We heard someone rehearsing a tricky passage on a bowed instrument, children arguing, a group of women laughing, an air-powered tool cycling. The air felt dense, the place closed in, deadening, stifling. Or perhaps that was just the food catching up with me.
Orb 4 is Ernuden, Leo finally said, waking us all up.
Yes, Jules said heavily. And all of you will be there.
Nothing personal, but I want you walking bombs out of my orb as soon as possible.
It is the highest numbered of the Ernuden orbs, Archibald observed, meaning, if I understand the convention, the farthest aft, the most residential,
Lowest in the hierarchy, yes, said Jules. The oldest, the most important stuff, the highest in the command, are in Orb 1.
That's the one you'd want to nuke.
Will we be visiting Orb 1?
Leo asked. Are we going to have an opportunity to nuke it?
I would be astonished, said Jules. The people there are very strange and hardly ever come out.
We all looked at each other.
Yes, said Jules. They are a little like your Thousanders.
Fitting, said Archibald, since their journey has lasted for 1,000 years.
It is doubly unfortunate the Fraudjad perished during the launch then, I said, since Orb 1 sounds like a place he would make a beeline for. That is, in a narrative where he had made it here with someone like me to open doors for him.
What do you imagine he'd do once he reached it? Asked Jessery, keenly interested.
It depends on what kind of reception we got when we came in the door, I pointed out. If things went badly wrong, we would not survive, and our consciousnesses would no longer track that narrative.